Once upon a time, a chemical company used the advertising slogan, "Without chemicals, life itself would be impossible." That is true, but coming from a chemical company, it struck some people weirdly. We'll focus on that fact at the center, that chemicals are in everything. Kate Bieberdorf hammers that point home in the book It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. Kate Bieberdorf is both scientist and science entertainer. She teaches chemistry at the University of Texas, wrote books on chemistry for kids, and has appeared on many a TV and radio show. Her website is katethechemist.com. Kate Bieberdorf, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It is good to have you. So how efficient do you have to be in trying to explain science to non-sciencey people?
Pretty efficient, for sure. I definitely try to approach it with fun, real-world examples, trying to make the science accessible. We've all been in one of those discussions, or maybe even had a professor who just went way over the top, went into the deep end, used all that jargon, and it's just not fun. So at least in my classroom, I try to make chemistry as fun as possible.
How did your mother help you realize you needed to explain chemistry to non-PhDs?
Oh, geez. So once I graduated with the PhD, I remember finishing the dissertation and I emailed a copy of it to my mom. And I thought, okay, finally, after 5 years, she's going to be able to sit down and read this whole thing and totally 100% understand what I've been working on. And I mean, not even 90 seconds after I emailed this draft to her, she called me up and she was laughing so hard because she didn't know what any of the words meant. And I like sent an email of like, now you're going to get it. Like you finally, like da, 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 da. And she just came back so hard with just, I don't know what any of these words mean. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't even know what a ligand is. And I was like, it's not even pronounced that way. So there was all this issues, but it was just one of these very eye-opening moments for me where I realized that it's a different language. And if chemists and people that are in the STEM world keep using our jargon, we're going to lose people. We're going to lose people who want to understand what's going on around them on a daily basis. And so in It's Elemental, what I tried to do is point out my favorite examples of science and things that we actually interact with on a day-to-day.
Which starts off with the morning coffee when you get to the second part of the book. I mean, and so let's talk about trimethylxanthine. I didn't realize that was something we consume on a regular basis.
Yeah, if you drink coffee, or I'm a Diet Coke girl personally, but the caffeine is trimethylxanthine. It's an odorless white powder. It's actually really bitter. If you were to try to bite into it, it would be disgusting. I'm sure you would not enjoy it. But essentially, trimethylxanthine or caffeine acts like a psychoactive drug. So just like nicotine or morphine does in your body, caffeine messes with the way our brain functions or behaves. So what's cool about caffeine is that it goes into your brain and it actually binds with receptors that are meant to bind with a completely different molecule. So this molecule, adenosine, goes into your brain and it makes us feel sleepy or drowsy. But what caffeine does is it blocks adenosine from bonding with our brain, so we don't even feel that sleepy or drowsy thing. So caffeine doesn't actually give us energy. It just blocks another molecule from making us feel sleepy.
I'll come back to breakfast later on, but I wanted to certainly get caffeine in there because I know some people may be reaching for that first cup when they're hearing this in the morning. So we'll give them a hand there with understanding the pathways of caffeine. That's really interesting that it blocks the sleepy binders. Obviously, It's Elemental is about deconstructing chemistry down to the molecular level, even to the atomic level and subatomic for that matter, too. Talk about the guys who first theorized atoms. It was longer ago than I would have expected.
Oh, completely. I mean, the history of chemistry is absolutely remarkable. And so I started off the book with doing just a tiny brief history. I didn't want to give everybody the horrible long story. But a long time ago, like years and years, thousands of years ago, we actually thought that there were only four elements. And so we thought there was air, earth, fire, and water. That's what we thought. And it wasn't until like hundreds and thousands of years later where a guy named Robert Boyle actually started picking that apart and saying, I think there's more to this. It's not just these four elements. And so he kind of proposed the idea of having elements, which is the same idea of what we use now. And now we have this incredible, beautiful periodic table that has all of our elements that we currently know of. But currently, what we believe of an atom is that it has a nucleus. And in the center, there's some protons and neutrons. And then on the outside of the nucleus, that's where our electrons float around. And it took us a very, very long time to figure this out. But it wasn't really until the 1600s where we started poking holes at that four element theory. And so the last maybe 400 years is where we've done a lot of our progress with chemistry. And I can't even wait to figure out what happens in the next 100 years.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, considering the ground we've covered in the last few hundred. So let's talk about the parts of the atom. Then the protons are usually equal in number to electrons. And then what happens if they're not balanced?
Well, sure. So let's talk about the atom structure. So like I said, the nucleus is in the center, and inside you have those protons and neutrons. So I like to equate the atom to the human body. So if the body is an atom, your insides, your liver, your kidneys, that's your protons, those are your neutrons. That's going to be inside. And so neutrons are neutrally charged. They don't carry a charge, but protons are positive. So the inside, your core, your belly button is very, very positively charged. But then on the outside of the nucleus, that's where our electrons hang out. And that's like our jewelry, our gloves. We can easily exchange that with another atom without having too big of a problem, right? So your electrons stay on the outside of your nucleus. Now, what you asked about is the charge of it. And so an atom on the periodic table, or an element, I should say, is considered to be neutral. So it carries a zero charge overall. But when an element starts doing chemical reactions, it's often trading or exchanging electrons. So it can gain electrons, which becomes more negative, and that becomes an anion. Or it can give away its electrons, meaning it becomes more positive overall, and that's a cation. And so these are just a couple terms that I introduced in the very beginning. It's a very small section of the book, but part one is essentially just, here's the vocab you need. What's an atom? What's a molecule? What's a physical change? What's a chemical change? So that I can get to part two, which is really the meat and the potatoes of the book, which is all the fun examples, the real world stuff, so that we don't get bogged down on the deep part of like the subatomic particles and everything, because that's not fun. A lot of people don't enjoy that stuff. They want to know what's going on in their coffee. That they understand.
So we talked a bit about the parts of the atom. Atoms obviously combine to form molecules. Molecules have shapes, as you point out. Some are linear, some are hexagonal or something like that. But do the molecular shapes, I wanted to know, Kate, influence the properties of the substances formed?
Oh, so much, so much. If that is one thing I could get across to just everybody in the entire world, is that the shape of the molecule really dictates what happens in its reactivity. So is it going to form a bond with a new molecule? Is it going to form an intermolecular force? And part of that is just the shape of the molecule. Can these two molecules even approach each other? So think about the human body again, or even spaghetti. Let's go with spaghetti. So if you have a spaghetti noodle that's nice and thin and linear, that can very easily fit into little holes or little areas. It's small, it's petite, and it can kind of slide into areas, which means it can very easily go through chemical reactions, usually. I mean, there's exceptions to everything in chemistry. But then if you have these really big molecules, like something with an octahedral shape, so something that's just has arms and legs coming out of it in every single direction, and it's just really not symmetrical, those molecules have a very difficult time interacting with other molecules because of something we refer to as sterics or steric hindrance, meaning that the molecule can't even access another molecule because of its shape. And so what I do in the book is just touch a little bit on how the molecules have these really common shapes. I just touch on the main ones and point out how if you have something that's maybe in a bent geometry like water, that makes water really accessible to other molecules. So water can very easily form bonds with other molecules and go through amazing physical changes or chemical changes and all that.
Well, okay, so this gets into things like the actual states, you know, and phase transitions, moving from one form to another, from solid to liquid, liquid to gas, et cetera. What is it that makes two gases, hydrogen and oxygen, form a liquid upon combining?
Oh, well, it's very interesting. So if we're talking about water specifically, the water molecule exists as H2O in the gas phase. And so they're just really, really spaced far apart. And so when something goes from the gas phase to a liquid phase, what's happening is the molecules themselves are getting closer together. We're not actually breaking bonds or making bonds. We're just decreasing the distance between the molecules. And so when they go really far, like when they're super far apart, that's a gas. The liquid is usually much closer together, and then the solid is usually much more compact. Again, there's exceptions to everything, and water is a classic example, which is why ice can float in liquid water. Usually solids sink to the bottom, but water is really unique and it has different properties. And I go into that just a little bit into the book, but I just think it's a fun example because we see that all the time.
All right, as long as we're on water, let's go to another liquid, but not an element, or that would be the milk in the coffee. We talked about coffee and what the caffeine actually is, trimethylxanthine. Talk about what the milk represents in chemistry terms.
Sure. So depending on what kind of milk you're using, it could be a number of different things. But if you have a milk where you've sorted all the fat out, it's practically water, we could refer to that as a homogeneous liquid. So it looks all the same. Everything is in the same phase. But sometimes we get certain types of milk where we have little droplets in there, maybe little fat droplets in there. But they're so small and they're so tiny and that when we stir them up completely, we can essentially get an emulsion, and we get this beautiful sample where we don't have chunks of fat floating on the top of our milk, because that would be disgusting. And so we're able to kind of mess with a little bit of chemistry here and allow for us to get some interactions. And because we've mixed the solution up so well, it appears to look homogenized, even though there's some little fat chunks really floating through in the inside, which is gross to think about, but milk's delicious.
Kate Bieberdorf is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. KateTheChemist.com teaches chemistry at the University of Texas, writes books on chemistry for kids, has appeared on many a TV and radio show, including this one. Her latest book is called It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. You're welcome to join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Ask questions about the chemicals that make up all the stuff around us. It's all there. It really makes you look at the room a different way. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's step away from milk and coffee and just talk about the ways in which when you challenge people to think about the stuff around them and the chemicals from which they are made, I mean, what are the things that seem to surprise people the most?
Oh, man, it really just depends on what people's interests are. So if I ever talk to someone who's like, oh, man, I hated my chemistry class, the first thing I want to say is, okay, what do you like? Tell me your hobbies, and I will start picking my favorite examples of science out of there. So, for example, if I have a gym buddy who likes to work out and they start telling me they hate science, I go into their clothing right away. I start talking about what type of material they like to wear. So a lot of people like dry fit clothing, which is actually trademarked by Nike, which is just the common term essentially for moisture wicking fabrics. But for these people, whenever I've had them say that to me, I go right into it and talk about how the dry fit is really just this beautiful blended polyester. And so it's this beautiful material that pulls the water droplets off of the athlete's body. And when that happens, the water can then spread out and then more quickly and easily evaporate. And when it goes from the liquid to the gas state, which we were just talking about, the molecules spread out, they grab the heat from your body because it's an endothermic transition. And then boom, your body has dried off. Your temperature has gone down, and it's all because of the chemistry going on in your fabric. Whereas something like cotton has the fabric that's woven through so tightly that the moisture can't easily evaporate. And so there's just so much science just in your clothing alone.
We have an email here from Krista in Eureka, who asks, why do the chemical names of additives seem to change over time? For example, phenoxyethanol used to be referred to as glycol. Do you think manufacturers change these names as the additive gets listed as hazardous? Asks Krista in Eureka.
Yes, that is absolutely a trick that some people try to do. I will say that we as a community try to come up with names that are a little bit easier to say. So, I think glycol is pretty easy to say, so I don't think that change would have been because of that. But in general, that is one thing, because I know if we're talking about something, if I say water, that's a lot easier for me to say than dihydrogen monoxide, right? So we do try to come with more friendly terms. But that is something you need to be aware of. I would definitely look at the back of all the bottles that you're using, especially if you're using things constantly, like in your shampoo and your conditioner. Check out the molecules there and see what's up. It can't hurt to read.
So generally, though, do chemists, when substances get named, try to be as accurate as possible? It seems like they're so multisyllabic that it's because they're trying to get some of the attributes of the chemical said in the name.
Yeah, and it depends on who's naming it and what the purpose is. So there's IUPAC, which is our standard, and they go through and they name the molecule specifically based on the connectivity and what functional groups are sitting on the molecule. But when we say something like methylamine or something like that, we're just trying to tell our friends that, hey, this is a big molecule, but what I really care about is this one methyl group or this one amine, or maybe it's a hydroxyl over there. So there's ways of kind of abbreviating things as well, and then just focusing on the part of the molecule that we care about. And we do that all the time in chemistry, especially those people who work with amino acids. We really just focus on one part of the molecule or maybe two sides of it, because that's where the chemistry is happening. That's where the electron exchanges are occurring. The rest of it is just sitting there watching like a spectator. So we sometimes refer to things as spectator or spectator ions because they are not participating in the chemistry at all.
So it seems like there, and you detail some of this in the book, that there have been some fights about how to classify things in chemistry and how to arrange, for example, the periodic table. And I didn't realize until you mentioned it in your book why tungsten is abbreviated to W. And was it mercury to Hg?
Yeah, exactly. So mercury, I always say this wrong, but it's hydrogerum, I believe. And so Hg, that's where that comes from. And then tungsten is usually wolfram. And so that's from the W. And it all comes from these battles that have been going on where two groups discover the element around the same time. One group calls it wolfram. One group calls it tungsten. How do you know what to call it, right? We don't want 67 names for the same element. We want the same thing. Everybody wants to know that carbon is carbon, no matter if you're on this side of the planet or that side. So that's where IUPAC came in, which is the International Union for Pure and Applied Chemistry. They came in and essentially set rules for naming elements. So now we have certain rules that we follow. But when it comes to new molecules, you usually get to name it if you discovered it. So that's why you see a lot of things named after certain chemists. We're quite egotistical. So,
well, Kate, the chemist, is the one talking about this. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Kate Bieberdorf teaches at the University of Texas, writes chemistry books for kids, has appeared on TV many times, and is the author of the new It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. You're welcome to join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 with questions or comments by phone, or email them to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's see, where was I going to go here? About the exercise chapter in the book. I guess I didn't expect the sentence, fat is simply a better source of fuel for our body.
Yeah, it is, though, because what happens with our body essentially is that you ingest food, right? So it comes down into your body. And the first thing we do is we have the enzymes in our stomach and our intestine, and they attack the food and they break it down. And so it's easier to break certain molecules down into glucose than others. Then in the second step, what we do is we break down our glucose even further. And so we make them into smaller molecules called pyruvates. And now the chemistry can get really complicated here. So I'm just going to jump to the next part where we essentially have these new molecules enter the citric acid cycle. And this is the whole point of eating food, is because when we do this, we can make a molecule called adenosine triphosphate. And that is our ATP. That's our molecular unit of currency. And so that ATP molecule is all over our body. So we have 1 billion molecules of ATP in any cell in our body. And it's just sitting there ready to go, ready to release energy anytime we want to do an action. And when we do that, we actually go through a combustion reaction. So it burns, it goes on fire. And so certain sources of fuel, which I'm saying fuel, but I really mean food, but certain sources of fuel just burn better. And so fat is actually better. We get more for it. It's like a better source of energy. So when we burn that, we release more energy and we can do more things in our body. So it's a really good source. And I go into that. But like I said, I try to keep things light and fun and keep things interesting as much as I possibly can, because I don't want to weigh you down with the details of citric acid cycle. I don't do that in the book. I don't go into the jargon. I just try to keep it light, because everybody eats food. Everybody does. Everybody goes for a run, hopefully, maybe, maybe not. But everybody takes care of their body and we work out. And so I think it's interesting to know how that works and how you can convert, you know, peanut butter pretzels into burpees in the gym.
Well, and this is not, by the way, a license to go out and eat a stick of butter because it's better.
No,
not like that.
No, not what I'm saying.
No, but it's interesting too, though, as you go further into exercises, is to talk about what, you know, and you just mentioned combustion. Our bodies actually burn these things. So how does the fat get out of our bodies?
I know this is the biggest misconception. Everybody thinks we sweat it out or we, like, you know, get rid of it in the restroom. But that's not the case at all. Like I was talking about, this is all a combustion reaction. So we burn these sources of fuel, and a combustion reaction, a classic one, releases carbon dioxide and water. And so every time you burn this fuel, you burn this ATP, you're releasing carbon dioxide, and then you just breathe it out of your lungs, which I think is so interesting. So you're actually breathing it out. You're just pushing it out through your mouth. That's how you're losing your weight. And it's just so crazy to think of all the different ideas that people have in their head of how you're actually losing weight, like through sweat, or I hear it all the time in the bathroom. People always think you're losing weight, like actually in the restroom. And that's not the case at all.
Okay. So yeah, don't try to make that the place you eliminate your fat. Yes. All right.
No.
So let's stick with exercise for a second, because I want to ask about the relationship between adrenaline and cortisol, because we know cortisol is the stress hormone. So what's the relationship between those two?
Well, cortisol is a steroid hormone, and so it's a very, very similar structure, but it's a really important molecule because it can cause both your blood pressure to increase, it can increase your blood sugar as well, and it's really good at turning your fats into energy. And so what happens is when you are releasing adrenaline, you're often releasing cortisol as well. And so cortisol is just really, it plays a huge process, a huge role in the gluconeogenesis that we were talking about before. And so we really truly believe that when you're in your kickboxing class and you're working out, your body's releasing both adrenaline and cortisol, and both of these hormones are actually playing a key role into converting our ATP and doing the combustion reactions. And it's amazing.
Well, cool. So does this help explain things like roid rage? I mean, the fact that when we're exercising hard and, you know, we got steroids going on, we're like getting into the stress hormone.
A little bit. Yeah, absolutely. We can talk about that. I definitely do not talk about using steroids in the gym. I just talk about the fact that cortisol is considered to be a steroid hormone, which just means it has this same structure. There's a basic core structure to the molecule itself, which is why we refer to it as a steroid molecule. But what's really neat is when you're going through a workout and you're going through these adrenaline rushes, you're also getting these endorphin releases. And so we have three different types of endorphins, the alpha, the beta, and the gamma endorphins, and all of them go out into your body. And so for a long time, we thought that these runner high that people were getting were all because of endorphin release, but that's not actually the case. We recently learned that these endorphins can't actually pass through your blood-brain barrier. And so what happens is there's another molecule that's going out. It's called anandamide, and that one goes through, and that's actually triggering your mood elevation. And so that's why we refer to that as the bliss molecule. So there's a lot of different things at play. You've got cortisol, you've got your adrenaline, and then you've got all these endorphins that are going through, plus you've got anandamide that's coming through. So there's just so many things. It's hard to isolate one or the other. But yeah, you are absolutely correct.
So are the endorphins good for the body and the anandamide works on the brain?
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll take that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, chemistry made simple with Kate the chemist. let me ask about other parts of the house, because the other chapters in the book are about getting dressed at the beach, in the kitchen, cleaning the house. Let's talk about the kinds of things because chemistry can get a little serious if you're cleaning the house with the wrong stuff.
Sure. Well, you can keep it really, really simple. So one of my favorite things to recommend is taking a lemon or anything that has citric acid, say a lime, an orange works, but not as well. But you can use that to remove the gunk from your sink drain. So if you just take a couple lemons, chop them up, and flush them down your dish disposal, it works extraordinarily well, because lemon has this molecule called citric acid. And it's a triprotic acid, meaning there's three different places where it can coordinate with minerals. And so usually when you have your gunk in your sink drain, it's usually because you have your hard water and all these minerals have adhered to the side of your pipes. But what happens is when you take something like a lemon or that citric acid or the triprotic acid with those three different places to coordinate, the lemon goes through and it essentially is like it gives the minerals something to be more attracted to than the side of the pipe. So as soon as they see that acid go down the drain, they're like, oh my gosh, this is the cutest acid I've ever seen in my entire life. They let go of the pipe, they grab the lemon, and then it just goes straight down through, and you'll see a major change. Plus, it smells so good because that acid is there's some aromatic molecules that are a bit volatile, I should say. So they go in the air, and so it smells like lemons. You've cleaned your pipe, and it's one of my favorite recommendations.
How about just the lemon juice if you don't have a disposal?
That works. Okay. Yeah, that works. Mm-hmm. The more concentrated, the better. And if you don't have that, you can use vinegar, because vinegar is also an acid. It's just not a triprotic acid, so it's not as strong.
Okay. Final question, because we're almost out of time here. Do you lose something on the radio by not being able to ignite cornstarch out of your mouth in front of a blowtorch?
Yes. Yes. I do miss that. It is definitely easier to sell books when you're on TV blowing something up. I was just on Wendy Williams for her birthday, and we blew up a huge cake, and it was so much fun. I really enjoyed that. So, but don't get me wrong. I love being on the radio. We can have more time to get into the details, and just the conversations are much better.
I'm glad we've had the time with you, and you know, I'm sorry we don't get to blow things up, but there's plenty of video of that out in the world at katethechemist.com and other sites. Kate Bieberdorf's latest book is called It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. Kate, thanks so much for the visit.
Thank you.
All right.